Welcome to Fisherwomen. I'm Katie Osborne. Today we are journeying to the eastern Bering Sea. If you picture Alaska as the head of an elephant, with the Aleutian Islands stretching out before it like the elephant's trunk, then the eastern Bering Sea is that area above the trunk and in front of the eyes of the elephant. This region is home to the largest fishery in the United States, the Alaska pollock fishery, which lands over 1 million tons of fish each year from the eastern Bering Sea alone. You've probably eaten Alaska pollock. They're a popular choice for fish and chips, fish sticks, and imitation crab. So what are Alaska pollock?
So they're a cousin of the cod, the Pacific cod. They're smaller than the Pacific cod, and they aggregate in extremely large schools, and it's a really sustainable species and product for Alaska.
That was Susie Zagorski, and the Alaska pollock fishery has been certified as sustainable by the Marine Fisheries Council. At the time of our conversation, Susie was field project manager for the North Pacific Fisheries Research Foundation. She is now a purser aboard the CP Starbound, an Alaska pollock fishing vessel. The fishery operates out of Dutch Harbor in the Aleutian Islands, 800 miles southwest of Anchorage as the albatross flies. If you've ever watched Deadliest Catch, it probably took place in Dutch Harbor. Crab fisheries might get all the screen time, but Alaska pollock is big business.
There's two seasons for it. There's winter A season, summer B season, and that A season is usually where we see the Chinook bycatch because pollock are bearing roe at that time.
And roe are everyone's favorite food. Easy to catch, nutritious, and filling. Just the thing for adult Chinook trying to earn their moniker as king salmon. Thanks in part to their large size, Chinook support important commercial, subsistence, and recreational fisheries. So if you're fishing for pollock, how do you do so without also catching Chinook salmon? Especially as Chinook appear to be attracted to pollock roe. That is the subject of today's episode and Susie's former work evaluating gear modifications to reduce catch of Chinook salmon in the Alaska pollock fishery. These modifications are effective. More than 99% of the fish brought aboard pollock fishing vessels are Alaska pollock. But as the Alaska pollock fishery is the largest in the nation, less than 1% bycatch still amounts to a lot of non-pollock fish, such as immature salmon and halibut, ending up in catch in terms of absolute numbers. So pollock fishermen continue to work with researchers like Susie to further reduce bycatch, especially of Chinook salmon. Susie, thank you so much for joining me on the show. You're in a rather niche field. Could you tell me what brought you to this work?
Absolutely. So I came from like a farming, fishing, hunting family, really always out on the boat, always fishing. And when I was in seventh grade, I knew that I wanted to be a marine biologist. So having family up here in Alaska, I decided to come up here for school. Did a four and a half year marine bio program at Alaska Pacific University. And it got to time to choose a junior practicum. So we do a junior practicum and a senior project. And I didn't really know much about bycatch or commercial fishing gear, but I had been learning about bycatch and habitat impacts. And it was just something that was really intriguing to me. And so I kind of came up with my own project to try and work with the longlining fishery to reduce skate bycatch. And it didn't really go anywhere. There weren't any connections. I didn't have a network set up to make that happen. But my advisor happened to know people at NOAA Fisheries in Seattle. And they just happened to have a project that was working on trawl gear modifications to reduce habitat impacts and to reduce bycatch. So that was a great opportunity, and I couldn't pass it up. And it provided me not only a senior project, but also a graduate project. And that graduate project, it was also gear modifications with trawl gear to reduce habitat impacts. And that whether it's changing gear to reduce habitat impacts or changing gear to reduce bycatch, it's all kind of one group of people up here. So by working on that project, I was then introduced to the rest of the Alaska world of gear modifications and bycatch reduction.
Great. You mentioned two flavors of gear modifications there, those that aim to reduce habitat impacts and those that aim to reduce bycatch. Could you expand on that a bit?
Yeah. So reducing habitat impacts usually has to do with any part of the gear that may come in contact with habitat. So for trawl gear, usually that's more focused on bottom trawls because they tend to run the bottom. A lot of times that's looking at the foot rope, the ground gear, anything that's going to come in contact with the seafloor or with anything that's a structure coming up off of the seafloor. For bycatch and reducing bycatch, the modifications for that are usually more based off of fish behavior, so the bycatch species behavior and its relation to the catch. Sometimes it's also having to do with size of fish. So halibut excluders are very different from salmon excluders. So those modifications are made. It's an entire section that's added into the net. So it's not on the foot rope. It's not the ground gear necessarily. It's usually a section added prior to the caught end where the catch is collected and then caught.
So the caught end is a section of finer mesh at the end of a net where catch collects and also serves as the access point to empty a net of catch. Now we'll be talking about bycatch a lot today. It's defined as the portion of animals captured unintentionally by a fishery. This can refer to all species caught other than the targeted species, in this case, Alaska pollock. But in a commercial or regulatory context, bycatch typically refers to the unintentional catch of vertebrates and other species of interest. That is to say, we are most concerned about incidental catch of species that have special protections, such as migratory birds or marine mammals, and species that we like to consume, such as salmon. Gear modifications to exclude certain species from catch have to be tailored to that species by their very nature. So for the rest of this episode, bycatch will refer specifically to salmon catch in the Alaska pollock fishery. Now back to Susie and the incentives in place to reduce salmon bycatch.
There's an incentive program to avoid and reduce salmon bycatch. All the boats, it's called a hard cap. All the vessels and companies, their quota also comes with a salmon bycatch hard cap. If the boat reaches their hard cap of salmon, there is usually a detrimental effect to either their quota or their fishing practice or ability to go fish. And it all depends on the co-op they're in or if it's a shared cap, shared quota of that PSC of salmon. But yes, there is definitely a lot of incentive to not reach that salmon hard cap and to not catch salmon.
So how do you do that exactly? You mentioned fish behavior earlier. Are you able to somehow influence the fish's behavior such that pollock will enter the net while salmon avoid it?
So this is kind of was a question near the beginning of when salmon excluders were starting to be developed and designed. So the behavior that we're cueing into is more so that salmon are stronger swimmers than pollock. So the way these excluders are designed, it gives a longer escape route for salmon to swim against a created current, whereas pollock should not generally be strong enough to swim against that for the amount of time that it takes to get out. And there's the occasional pollock that can actually swim that, but compared to the amount that's being caught, it's practically nothing.
Okay, so you're using the swimming abilities of salmon to your advantage. How do you refine that approach and decide what your next study question is going to be?
So there's usually a multitude of questions that go into our testing. The first big question we tackle is, what salmon excluder design do we think is going to give us a higher rate of salmon escapement, but also maintain the efficient catch of pollock? This has always been questioned because there's multiple types of salmon excluders out there that it's questioned whether they work. One type works better on a larger vessel versus a smaller vessel, or whether it has to do with towing speed or area that you're fishing. Once we come up with the design we want to test, then our next big question is its performance. How is it working? So we want to know not only the rate of salmon escapement per tow, but then also how much target loss is there. And so that target loss helps us understand the efficiency of it. If the salmon excluder is not performing well by reducing salmon bycatch, and it's also allowing a lot of target loss, then that's not going to be a successful salmon excluder for us. There's definitely a balance there, but we would rather see our salmon numbers higher, our salmon escape numbers higher, much, much higher than our target loss.
Absolutely. And from your description, I'd imagine a lot of work goes into selecting a study question. So what sort of preparation and processes have to happen before you can actually get out on the water and test those gear modifications?
There's about a year's worth of prepping before we ever get to testing, at least year to half a year, depending on if we had any tests that year prior. So the first step in it is usually workshopping with the industry partners, with fishermen who are interested in bycatch reduction and gear modifications. And there is a group of people who, especially in Alaska fisheries, who work on excluders. And so they're always there participating as well. So usually we go off of previous years or previous experience with different types of excluders. And we workshop and we figure out, you know, what do we want to try next? What is the industry looking to try next? And how do we go about that? Usually there is then a step to go to a flume tank. And a flume tank is, it's where we can test a scaled down version of an excluder, of a net, to see how it's reacting in similar water flow. So we're trying to recreate what it would look like while fishing, but without any fish or a boat. And this gives us a side profile to see actually how, you know, how the net is hung, how the excluder is hung, how different parts and pieces of it are working and what we need to adjust. So that's where we do our fine scale adjustments before we take it out to the ocean and put it on into a trawl net on a big boat. Then we look to, once we kind of have an idea of what gear we want to test out that year, what excluder we want to test, then we look at the details of what data we're going to be collecting. For the last 3 years, the EFP that I've been working on, so the exempted fishing permit that we've been working under to test these salmon excluders, so we want to try and see what other factors that are going on in fishing that might be affecting our escape rates. So is it tow speed? Is it light? Is it catch rate? There's all these different covariates and variables that we can try to test. So figuring out our method and how we want to test this, specifically tow by tow, is then that next step before we actually send everything up to Dutch Harbor, including myself and a lot of gear and a lot of cameras, make sure everything works, and we get it onto the boats, and the boats will then attach it to their fishing gear. And all the boats that we test on are part of the permit, so we have to, of course, schedule with them, you know, when they're going to fit this testing into their own fishing schedule.
Speaking of fishing schedule, you get to be out on the boat for the gloriously long, sunny days of summer, yes?
No. Our main fishing season, testing season, is a season, so usually January, February, sometimes into March. This last February, there was definitely still some ice out there. Some of our boats had a little bit of ice buildup, so that was fun. We want to really test on Chinook salmon to see if they're going to escape out of these salmon excluders. So we have to go up and we have to test during a season where we're going to see those higher Chinook So yeah, every day it's get up, you know, put your layers on. You gotta make sure you have some insulated boots, because too much time on deck and some non-insulated boots, your feet get really cold. A lot of times the Grendon's fishing layers that we wear, as long as you're not getting soaked by a wave, they're pretty warm. I would say the cold and the dark, yeah, it's really not as bad as most people think it would be. And I might just be biased because I already live up here. On the boats, we always have the lights running. Out on deck, it's not dark. All the boats are lit up real bright. And when I work on the boats, it's every tow. And some of those tows are at night anyway. So sometimes I don't even know if it's day or night because it's just go, go, go. So that part, it's not that bad, I would say, just because there's always deck lights, running lights on those boats. One, for safety, but also so we can actually see what we're doing out there.
That makes total sense. And those boats are operating out of Dutch Harbor. So you are also operating out of Dutch Harbor. What's it like to live and work in such a far-flung place? Because I've looked it up. It's out there.
Yes, it is out there. I think it's like 700 miles from Anchorage, which is my home. And I operate out of there. So all of our boats go in and out of Dutch Harbor. So we don't really go to Accutane. We don't go to Adak or any of the further islands. All of our boats, since they're Pollock, they deliver shoreside. So they deliver back to Dutch Harbor, and there's enough infrastructure out there. I would say it's actually quite a bit for the Aleutian Islands. And it's all very fishery specific. That's one of the main things that happen out there is fisheries. So we have some of our net manufacturers, they come out there during the fishing season. So if we have any issues that is more than what I or the crew can handle, we'll go talk to them. And I spend anywhere from a month to a few months out there. It just depends on how many trips we have, if this is the only contract I'm working on, or if I'm helping out other boats. And I usually have to take everything with me. So I come with a lot of gear.
Yeah, I believe it. So you've got all your gear and you're ready to start testing those gear modifications. What does that look like? Would you walk me through a typical day in the field?
First off, I come on with a bunch of cameras and I already have them set up somewhere near deck or on deck so that they can be added into the net. That's how we collect all of our, or how I collect all of our data to know if these salmon excluders are working, is via underwater camera. So, you know, I get the notification or I'm aware that we're about to set on another haul. So I go down to deck, I take my laptop, I take, you know, my notebooks, everything that I'm going to need down there, some music and headphones, you know, gear up. So it's all the fishing gear, boots, hard hat, life jacket, radio, and get all of our cameras set up. So every excluder, we come up with an amount of cameras and the location where we're going to set the cameras. And those are already marked in the fishing gear prior to testing. So we go and set that up. So as soon as I'm out there, I make sure I have all the cameras that we need that are set to the right camera angles for when they're in the net. And they all turn on with an activation plug so that there's no accessing the inside of our camera unit. So that there's no like seawater contamination or anything like that. So turn them all on. That turns their light on. It turns their recording on. And usually a crew member or two will come and they'll help me carry the cameras out to the gear. So then we're on deck. We have all the cameras laid out and we start clipping them in. They just clip straight to the mesh. And once they're all set in place, they are all working, they're all turned on, lights on, recording, and they look good. You know, we do a double check, make sure all the clips are on, because it would not be good to lose one of those. And it depends on the boat. Some boats, I'm actively clipping them and in the gear and making sure they're there. And some boats, because of safety, I'm guiding the crew who's doing all the attachments. So once that's done, you know, I head back to my staging area or wherever I have the rest of the cameras. And at that point, I'm usually downloading the previous tow's video. So we're always fishing back to back. When we set, it's usually right after a haul back. And so there's always more video to be downloaded from the previous tow to be reviewed. And that's usually when they do that. So once that gear is set, you know, I'm usually collecting data while we're setting from the boat. After that, then I'm going back to a video, doing video review from the previous tow, making sure it's downloaded, making sure the data is collected. And then we just do that over and over.
All right. And once you've done that over and over for an entire field season, so you've got all your videos, all your environmental data, what do you do next?
I watch hours and hours and hours of video review. So all that video, usually we have two or more cameras attached to the excluder to record this excluder performance for us to get data from. And so a lot of times I'm watching 2 to 4 times the amount of fishing time. I have to be very tuned into what's going on with that excluder. And I'm not only looking for fish. I'm not just, you know, counting one fish, two fish. But we're also looking for net shape, excluder shape, fishing behavior of how the excluder is performing. You know, sometimes we'll see a side current and I'll make note of going on with the shape of the excluder and why. So I'm always watching it one video at a time. Sometimes it's, you know, I have to be slowed down if there's a lot of activity in the excluder, and sometimes I can speed it up, make it go a little bit faster if there's not a lot of activity. But yeah, always keeping an eye out for if there's salmon coming out, if it's pollock, I'm counting every pollock that may be escaping. With the quality of our cameras, I can sometimes even identify the salmon to species. But just by shape, we can tell if it's a salmon, if it's a pollock, if it's cod, or any other random fish that may get out.
So once you have your results, how do you then share your findings? How does your work get incorporated into the day-to-day methods employed by the Alaska pollock fishery?
It's a very collaborative process. As I'm out there, I'm always talking to the captain, the crew. We're talking about, you know, the design. If I'm seeing results in the video right away, I'm usually showing the captain and the crew so that they can understand what's going on. All through that process, they're already coming up with their own ideas and speculations and what they think about that excluder. We also will usually at the end of video review, at the end of data collection, we usually take this back to the net makers, the net manufacturers, and they're also a lot of times involved in our workshops that happen perfectly timed after fishing season, after a lot of this testing has been, or a lot of the video has been reviewed, and once we kind of have a lot of those results. We like to collaborate really closely with the industry members, especially those involved, so that they are part of the process, so that they know what's going on, whether or not this excluder is working. Because a lot of the excluder designs have actually come from their ideas. They're seeing something in a video and they say, hey, actually, what if we do this? What if we try and make this change? So it's really important to have them involved every step of the way to know what's going on.
Definitely. That's so great. Now, before I ask you one last fun question, are there any final thoughts that you would like to share?
I mean, this work is really important, bycatch reduction and supporting not only our local fishery up here in Alaska, but helping them be a cleaner, efficient fishery. I would like to point out that it's not a solo effort. While it is very niche, there is a large group of people who are very involved with this, and everybody who is involved, we're all playing a really important part in it, especially when it comes to the collaboration. The fishermen play just as an important part as the scientists involved and the managers involved. So it's a whole project involving everybody.
And what a great thought to end on. Now, before you go, is there a favorite fish story you would like to share?
So I sport fish a lot, especially up here in Alaska. And, you know, Alaska is known for its salmon sport fishing. You go out to the Kenai River or the Russian River. So my family came up last summer. First time they ever went salmon fishing. They've done halibut fishing before, but first time salmon fishing. So we're wading in the river, and there's a shallow riverbank, and then it drops off to where we're usually fishing. But all along the riverbed is just salmon carcass after salmon carcass. It's the head, it's the backbone, tails, whatnot. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. Of course, the marine biologist, fishery scientist, thinks all the dead salmon carcasses is cool. Everybody else just kicks them away, walks around them. So we're out there fishing, help my dad catch his first salmon, which is also really cool. So we go back to the bank, and I'm bleeding my dad's salmon for him so that he can go keep fishing and try to catch another one. So while I'm down there, it's bleeding out. There's nothing much for me to do. So I'm like, you know what? I am actually going to pull one of these salmon heads, and I'm going to see if I can get the otolith out. Because what marine biologist doesn't like finding a random otolith to add to their secret otolith collection, right? And where we're at is a really popular spot on the Kenai River. So I'm out there. I've got my Vicky knife out, and I'm hacking open this salmon head that's been laying in the river. And people walk up, and they're like, whoa, what are you doing? And by that point, my dad came and joined me and was kind of keeping an eye on me. He was like, oh, she's a marine biologist. She's a fisheries scientist. And that's, she's getting, like, my dad knew it. And I was like, oh, my gosh. So I'm sitting there. I'm still cutting it open and whatnot. And these people are intrigued. It's like, it's always fascinating to me how much of fishery science or marine biology that people don't know. It was just a really exciting moment as I'm doing something that nobody else out on the river is doing, cutting open salmon heads to pull the otoliths out. And then I'm sitting there just teaching these tourists, a small family of tourists, what an otolith is, and showing them the brain and the optic nerves. And it was just a fun little marine bio lesson. And then I come to find out later that it wasn't only a really cool thing for my dad to see me, like, teaching other people about what I've learned and, you know, my passion for fish and for fishing. But then one of my cousins, who I adore, like, she was even enamored by the fact that I was just so easily able to, you know, share a bit of marine biology with people and that they were intrigued as well. I would say that's probably one of my favorites for now, until a new favorite comes about.
I like it, and I love when education and recreation collide. Thank you so much for the interview. It's been great to hear about research that is so responsive to changing needs and collaborative with the fishery. If you would like to follow Susie in her fishery adventures, learn more about Alaska pollock, or find some good sustainable seafood picks, please follow the links in the show notes. And now it's time for our creature feature. Today's creature feature is on swordfish and partial endothermy, which is the middle ground between the cold-blooded, warm-blooded dichotomy we're all taught in school. Fish, like reptiles and amphibians, are ectotherms, literally an organism that draws heat, or therms, from the external environment, or ecto. Like a lizard basking on a fence, fish swim through warmer or colder waters to warm up or cool down. This is called behavioral thermoregulation. An animal adapts its temperature to its environment and moves to warmer or cooler areas as needed. In contrast, birds and mammals are endotherms. We generate our heat internally and maintain a relatively stable body temperature so that our enzymes can operate at peak efficiency. Due to differences between ectotherms and endotherms, you can easily catch a lizard in the shade, while a bird in the shade can flee just as quickly as a bird in the sun. But several species of fish occupy a middle ground between ectothermy and endothermy called partial endothermy. Partial because these fishes are able to elevate the internal temperature in at least a portion of their bodies relative to their environment, but do not maintain a stable, established body temperature, like our 98 degrees Fahrenheit. Endothermic, because these fish have evolved the ability to physiologically thermoregulate. That is, the ability to warm critical organs or regions of the body internally. Two types of endothermy have evolved in fish, cranial endothermy and systemic endothermy. Today, I'll be talking about the first one, cranial endothermy. We'll talk about systemic endothermy next time. Cranial endothermy is found in billfishes, a term that refers to swordfish, marlin, and sailfish. These are highly migratory species that eat small schooling fishes such as sardines or anchovies. To hunt, swordfishes corral a school of fish while cutting with their beaks to stun their prey. Then they wheel on their prey and swallow up the stunned individuals. This type of hunting requires quick reflexes, but a cold brain slows thinking and cold eyes slow reaction time. Not exactly what a cold-blooded predator needs. In contrast, warm eyeballs respond more quickly to changing stimuli, invaluable to predators needing to respond swiftly to their prey's movements. So specialized thermal tissue in the skull of the swordfish heats the eyes and the brain. This allows swordfish to pursue their prey to the frigid depths of the ocean while keeping their eyes and brains warm, sharp, and operating at top speed. The thermal tissue found in a swordfish's skull is derived from the muscles around the eyes. Eye muscles must contract rapidly in order to track small changes in one's surroundings. These rapid eye muscle contractions generate heat, and the thermal tissue in swordfish uses countercurrent heat exchange to retain this warmth. Heat loss is further reduced thanks to a thick layer of fat insulating the brain and thermal tissues. Thanks to this arrangement of tissues, swordfish can keep their brain and eyes up to 15 degrees Celsius or 59 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the surrounding waters. Talk about a bunch of hotheads. And that's the show. Thank you once again to my wonderful guest, Susie Zagorski. And thank you so much for joining me today on Fisherwomen. It is great to be back. If you love seafood and want to make sustainable choices, I highly recommend downloading the Monterey Bay Aquarium's Seafood Guide, which can be used offline. If you would like to learn more about any of the topics discussed in today's episode, please refer to the resources listed in the show notes. I'm always accepting new creature features. Learn more and submit yours at fisherwomenpod.com. You can also follow Fisherwomen on social media for even more fishy content. The Fisherwomen theme was mixed by me using sounds sourced from SFX Go, Orange Free Sound, and Free Sound. Cover photo for this episode comes from Susie Zagorski. Come back in 2 weeks for the next episode and subscribe now so you don't miss a thing. Until then, happy fishing.
The observers tend to, and this is just what I've heard, but they tend to like cleaner toes because the processing does go a lot easier.